From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To the Point.
World hunger. What's America's role? Hello again, I'm Oren Almy, and this is To the Point. 70 million people are food insecure. Famine has been declared already in one country and predicted in three more in Africa and the Arabian Peninsula. The UN set a deadline for tomorrow, $4.4 billion for food and water, but less than a tenth has been received despite drought, disease, and warfare. The U.S. has led the world in past disaster relief, but President Trump wants massive cuts, and his aides are asking why America should care. Meantime, the world faces what could be one of the biggest humanitarian crises since World War II. On our talking point later, the House investigation of Russian meddling has collapsed into partisanship. Can the Senate do any better? First, the news.
Check out KCRW's all-news channel, News 24. Programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more. 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To the Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Warren Allen, back with To the Point. In Africa and the Arabian Peninsula, there's an acute shortage of food and clean water, but the UN has received just a fraction of the money needed for the relief or prevention of famine. Will the Trump administration push for budget cuts rather than making donations? Today's talking point, the House committee investigating Russian interference in last year's U.S. election has collapsed, apparently with help of the Trump White House. Now a Senate committee promises to go forward on a bipartisan basis. We'll hear what to look for in the upper house. First, this news update. North Carolina's Republican-dominated legislature today reversed its controversial bathroom bill. It had required transgender people to use public restrooms reserved for gender designated on their birth certificates. As a result, there was corporate pushback. The NCAA had to move its playoff games to other states. Both Duke and North Carolina had to play across the state line in South Carolina. David Graham is based in North Carolina for The Atlantic. And David, great to have you back on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Always good to be here.
Wasn't just corporations, wasn't just a matter of money. The fans didn't like this either, did they?
That's right. It was corporations, it was fans. You know, this is a basketball crazy state. And the bill has been pretty unpopular, more or less, from the moment it passed. The question has just been how to repeal it.
So how did they do it, and did they make everybody happy?
They certainly did not make everybody happy. So the bill that passed just now in the House and is headed to the governor now repeals HB 2, the original bill, but it sets a moratorium on cities in the state passing their own non-discrimination measures, whether that's bathroom measures, general LGBT employment discrimination, or for that matter, higher minimum wages until 2020. So it reverses the bill, but it prevents cities from doing anything to, protect LGBT people.
It focuses on LGBT, but it also includes minimum wage requirements?
That's right. One of the original measures was that it prevented any city from passing a higher minimum wage within city limits. And so the new bill maintains that prohibition, at least through 2020.
So there's a moratorium now on cities doing their own or providing their own assistance to LGBT people. There's a Republican-dominated legislature that did this. What about the Democratic governor? Is he going to sign it?
The Democratic governor was really very central to this. He has been working on a negotiation trying to get this done, really ahead of an NCAA deadline for future events in the state. Up through 2022. And so he was trying to cut a deal for months, really back to before he had even taken office. What's interesting about this is that a deal that was actually maybe less restrictive on cities failed in December for that reason. And so now Cooper is passing this. Democrats were split. Some of them voted for this bill, some voted against. I think enough decided they wanted to repeal the bill, that it was worth it. But progressive activist groups and grassroots groups are, I would say, hopping mad about the compromise and very unhappy.
So it's not a long-term solution, then. Could it be changed before this moratorium runs out?
In theory, the legislature could pass its own law changing this and overruling this. The situation is, because of the way districts work, Republicans have a pretty strong hold on the legislature for the foreseeable future. So it's unlikely that you'd see much movement, at least towards a looser version of this.
Serious gerrymandering there, and they were even taking away the powers of the Democratic governor. He's gone to court over that. What's happened to that?
There's been a various decisions there. Courts have ruled that an overhaul of the elections board was not constitutional, but that a requirement that he have his nominees for cabinet posts be confirmed was. And there's still some wrangling on a few of the other matters. So even as they're fighting over those things, they have reached this deal on HB2.
Back to the NCAA. Are the basketball teams going to come back and play in the state, or do we know that yet?
We don't know. So Democrats who met with Governor Cooper this morning said he told them that the NCAA, the NBA, and the ACC had all said they supported this deal. If you read what the NCAA said when they pulled out of the state, it's not clear that the new law meets all the conditions it requires, and the NCAA has been notably quiet publicly so far. So we're still waiting to see if this will actually meet their standard.
This also had to do with corporations and where they locate headquarters and what kind of advertising they do. Could have cost the state a lot of money. Has that been avoided or not?
Yeah, so the latest estimate is this is going to cost the state almost $4 billion over a dozen years. We're starting to see statements rolling in from corporations. The North Carolina Chamber of Commerce said it supported the repeal. Red Hat, which is a major software company with a presence in Raleigh, says it supports it. Some of the bigger companies that we haven't heard from include PayPal and Deutsche Bank, which pulled back on job expansion. So we'll see if this induces them to come back to North Carolina.
So obviously, this is a momentary solution to a problem that an issue that may continue for some time. What are the LGBT people specifically saying about it? What are they planning to do?
They were out trying to rally votes against this and convince Democrats not to support it, which was unsuccessful. What they say is they're going to continue litigating against anything any discrimination, and they'll continue to litigate against this law if they can, and they're going to continue to lobby for looser laws and to protect to allow non-discrimination ordinances. But I think a lot of them are taken a little bit by surprise. This happened very fast, although there have been rumors about repeal for weeks. This deal was just announced last night, and it gave opponents very little time to kind of rally against the bill.
Okay, very quickly, can transgender people now use the bathroom of their choice?
It's really unclear. The state doesn't say they're not allowed to, but cities can't protect their right to do so.
David Graham with The Atlantic, as always, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you.
In a moment, World Hunger, what's America's role? On To The Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
Well, and I'll be back with To The Point. In South Sudan, famine already has been officially declared. Parts of Nigeria and Somalia in Africa are likely to be next, along with Yemen on the Arabian Peninsula. Jeffrey Gettleman has been reporting on the increased desperation of some 20 million people in Africa and in the Arabian Peninsula. He's a reporter for The New York Times and author of the upcoming book Love Africa, a memoir of romance, war, and survival. He joins us from Nairobi. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Sure.
It's really a survival we're talking about at this point.
Yeah, I know. I feel bad, like you referencing my book. Definitely. There are 20 million people who, without urgent humanitarian need, face starvation. And this really couldn't come at a worse time. The U.S. government, which is one of the biggest funders of humanitarian operations around the world, is talking about slashing foreign aid. And at the same time, you have wars in Iraq and Syria and Libya. It kind of feels like the whole world is in turmoil. So as this drought is moving across Africa and putting many areas into crisis mode, there's a real fear of where is the money going to come from? Where is the help going to come from? And what's going to happen to all these people who really don't know where their next meal is going to come from?
So tell us, if you will, describe what's going on in some of these countries and just what conditions are like. It's not always the same in each place.
No, but you have a really bad drought shaping up in Africa right now. And I went to Somalia about 2 weeks ago and visited an area that was incredibly parched. Just picture a very dry, dusty landscape, what little grass is, yellow and brittle, a completely blue sky with not a cloud in sight, and people trudging in from the hinterlands where rivers have dried up and farms have dried up, looking for help. And they congregate around urban areas, hoping for some relief. And quickly, that leads to a whole new set of problems, like disease spreading in these internally displaced persons' camps. There's a big cholera outbreak going on right now in Somalia. Cholera is a preventable disease and an easily treatable disease. But if you don't have any food or medicine or clean water, it just jumps from person to person. And hundreds of people have died from it, and thousands more may soon die from it. And that's just in one spot of Somalia. And you have a similar situation happening in South Sudan, and also in Nigeria and Yemen. So the worry is that one of these crises would be a big enough problem for the world's humanitarian system to handle, and now we have four of them.
$4.4 billion asked by the UN, just a tenth of it received so far. Has the United States contributed anything?
Yeah, I think they probably pay a certain amount per month into UN accounts, but there's talk of eliminating that or drastically reducing that. And the United States pays something like a quarter of the UN's budget. So any little decrease by the American government of what it contributes to the UN is going to have an enormous impact. And already in some areas, they're cutting back on rations because they just don't have the money. And I was speaking to some people from UNICEF today about child protection issues because they just don't have the money to help protect children who were child soldiers, children who were separated from their families. It's like a real big mess. And again, all these crises are happening at the same moment, and you just get a sense that the aid community is very stressed out and doesn't have any quick solutions of how to respond to all these different fires that they got to put out.
What do the people themselves involved tell you when they're able to speak to you?
Well, it's really sad because a lot of people don't quite understand what causes these preventable illnesses. So I was at a cholera treatment center where there were dozens of people who were getting sick from cholera. It's this whole cycle that starts with their wells dry up and they're left with really dirty, mucky, cloudy, muddy water to drink. That gives them, you know, bacterial stomach disease, and then they spread that from person to person. And I was asking people, I said, you know, why do you think, you know, so many people are getting sick? And one nomad looked at me and he said, well, this happens, you know, from time to time. It's the hot season. And he thought it was the weather directly that was making people sick. So it's really hard to address a problem like that if the population you're dealing with just has, you know, very little inkling of what's happening. And there's just a sense, you know, of kind of hopelessness that, you know, even if these people make it through this season, what does that mean? Their farms have disappeared. They've, you know, lost or sold everything they owned. Their kids are on the move, you know, not being educated. You know, it just makes you feel really depressed about, you know, okay, if they survive this crises, what does it mean next year or a few years from now? How are they going to get out of it?
Jeffrey Gettleman, again, East Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. Ann Thomas is with us. She is Water Sanitation Hygiene Chief at UNICEF in Somalia. Thank you very much for being on our program.
Thank you.
Tell us more about the role of water or the lack of water or the pollution of water and how much that is contributing to the problem.
Well, you know, I think Jeffrey covered some of this, but, you know, the first thing to say is that cholera is a waterborne disease, and it's transmitted by the contamination of water, by feces. So it thrives in environments where you have this cross-contamination happening. So what's happening in the current situation of the drought is that we have a situation where primary water sources are drying up. People are moving to less safe water sources like open, unprotected ponds, for example. And then you combine this with a very low level of hygienic behaviors that is pre-existing in Somalia. For example, there's very low level of usage of latrines and very low level of practice of hand washing with soap. And most people don't know about treating their water. So when you combine that kind of practice and knowledge with the prevailing conditions right now, it's rife for cross-contamination of water sources and the transmission of diseases like cholera. So, and then further compounding it is the fact that people are now moving in search of water and pasture. So you have a situation where people are congregating in informal settlements with absolutely no services, low level of hygiene practices, and it just becomes a hotbed of disease. Now, for UNICEF, a particular concern is that children in these environments become particularly susceptible. So a lot of the children who arrive in the camps, you know, have trekked long distances. They suffer from malnutrition, and there is a vicious cycle between malnutrition and infections of the gut. And so it just sends them on this downward spiral that's very difficult to recover from.
And Jeffrey Gettleman, it's my understanding that when they move, as you have both indicated, those that depend on animals have a problem because they often move too late to save their herds, lose those then, and become essentially propertyless.
Well, a lot of these people live and die for their animals, and they will go nowhere without their animals because that's their wealth. That's their survival. And it's kind of sad because there's all these ecological pressures on pastoralism. This part of the world is getting drier and more prone to drought because of climate change. There is less available land because of increased urbanization. And there's a lot more people. I mean, that's the biggest factor. You have so many more people, and these populations are increasing really fast. So you need a lot of land to graze animals, and that amount of land is shrinking with a lot, you know, more people competing for it. So it just doesn't seem sustainable, this way of life, the way it's being practiced right now.
There have been famines for many, many centuries since biblical times. How is it that the situation is so much more difficult now than it's been in the past? Are there methods of adaptation that simply aren't available now?
Well, I think famines have been bad in the past, and that doesn't make it any easier for the people going through it right now. But I think the population pressures we're seeing today are unlike any other time in human history. And a lot of these countries just do not have the carrying capacity. They do not have the fertile land to support these growing herds and these growing groups of people. So I think that's the biggest enemy right now. If there really isn't land management in this part of the world to sort of deal with this population boom that's happening and that a lot of people are afraid of. I think Anne could speak to this, but I think UNICEF had done a report in the last year projecting the population of Africa 25 or 50 years from now, and it's, you know, a staggering increase.
And Thomas, back to you with UNICEF. How could that happen if so many people are dying because they don't have food and water?
Well, you know, I think this is, I mean, an issue. You know, there are some really interesting resilience practices that have been practiced for years. Recently, I was in the northern part of Somalia, and you know, I was quite amazed that, you know, the communities there, the nomadic communities in particular, have evolved some really interesting ways of coping with climate stress. But as Jeffrey said, you know, I think the changes in climate are becoming more extreme and more dramatic, and the coping mechanisms are being worn thin. But just to give you an example, you know, in the north we have less clans, so it's much more homogenous in terms of the divisions between different clans. And so people will actually take strangers into their homes as a coping mechanism during the drought and share everything that they have with them because they're perceived to be from the same, you know, broader family or ancestry, rather. So that was one. Another interesting example we saw was where nomads were actually taking advantage of a thriving private sector that exists in Somalia and taking a $1,200 ride to regions where there had been rain. Now, that was astounding for me because, you know, I didn't realize that the cost of one camel was equivalent to $1,000. So I think there are some coping mechanisms, and certainly we see a very big difference between what's happening in the north and what's happening in the south, where you have south, you have more agricultural populations dependent on two major rivers. And as the rivers run dry, these populations are even less resilient than the nomads in the sense that they have one income stream. And so they're the ones that tend to flock to the cities and congregate in the large camps. So what we're seeing in the southern part of the country is a large influx of internally displaced persons in the range of 1.2 million people that are internally displaced. And that's roughly 10% of the population of Somalia just displaced in the southern part of the country. And that's in comparison to about 200,000 that we see in the north.
Wow. You talk about people, some clans being willing to help people from other clans, strangers, in order to help them get through all of this. Elizabeth Bryant is with us. She's communications officer for the World Program in Dakar, Senegal. And thank you for being on our show.
It's a pleasure.
There's a lot of conflict in some parts of Africa, particularly because of Boko Haram. How is that contributing to the kind of humanitarian disaster that we're hearing about?
Yeah, it's a big issue because, you know, as Anne and Jeffrey were talking about, of course, there's the issue of drought, et cetera. But at least for the area of northeast Nigeria and some of the areas around the larger Lake Chad Basin, you know, the conflict is really perhaps the tipping point that's a key reason why so many people are going hungry. In northeastern Nigeria, something like 4.7 million people right now are what's considered food insecure, that's extremely hungry. There is a risk of famine. It's not happened yet. And that could rise to 5.1 million in the lean season. That's coming up, and that's when people, their resources are just totally depleted. And usually it's a time when people are also, farmers are planting, and they can't do that because they don't have access to their fields. And, you know, this is happening, you know, at, of course, as we've been talking about, at a time where, you know, there's, you know, there's this, again, this drought and a difficulty already to grow, but then people can't access their fields, or they may be internally displaced. And over the years, their resources have essentially dwindled down. And to top that off with the conflict, they also can't get to safe areas. So it's like a multiple whammy that's really hitting some of the people, especially in this part of northeastern Nigeria that's extremely of concern to many humanitarian agencies.
What about the forces of the governments involved? Are they able to counteract Boko Haram and other similar kinds of groups, or does the fighting simply go on?
I think for humanitarian agencies, the issue is access, and the issue is, you know, regardless of the parties, is being able to get to people in need. And the government has been working with humanitarian agencies when it can to access areas, but there's still many places where agencies can't get to. Often they're places where the food insecurity is feared to be, you know, really a worry, a very big worry. You know, World Food Program, for example, is looking for sort of more, you know, imaginative ways to reach people, to find out what the food security situation is, for example, through mobile phones to assess the needs. But it is a really big issue, and it's not just a question of access, of, you know, a one-time access to deliver food, but really, you know, a long-standing access so people can get back to their fields.
Elizabeth Bryant again with the World Food Program in Dakar, Senegal. We're going to continue this conversation after we take a very brief break on our talking point later. The House investigation of Russian meddling has collapsed into partisanship. Can the Senate do any better? This is To the Point from PRI. Warren Olney here, host of To the Point. When I'm not on the air, I like to keep up with podcasts. This American Life and The Daily by The New York Times, they both appeal to me. Sometimes when I ask my otherwise brilliant guests after the show what they listen to, they admit they haven't figured out the whole podcast thing. That's when I remind them, you were just on a podcast of To the Point. It's nothing but radio liberated. So if there's a podcast you love, share it with the smart people in your life. Well, and I'll be back with you to the point. Once again, talking about people who are going without food and water in North Africa, northeastern Africa, in Western Africa. The same thing is also true in Yemen, in the Arabian Peninsula. Altogether, 20 million people in that kind of a situation. But worldwide, we're talking 70 million people who are food insecure. Chris Funk is research director for the Climate Hazards Group at UC Santa Barbara. He's also a geographer with the U.S. Geological Survey and the Famine Early Warning Systems Network. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, Warren.
Were you able, with the Early Warning Systems Network, to predict the famines that are either already underway or about to be underway?
Well, so my specialty, Warren, is to predict drought, which is just, you know, one potential contributing factor to famine. And certainly, yes, in the case of Somalia this year, we were very successful in being able to predict that. And more in general, the Famine Early Warning System Network has been, you know, very successful in, you know, identifying these crises in Nigeria and South Sudan and Yemen, along with our partners in the World Food Program and other agencies.
So you are able to predict them to some extent, but does that mean that people get ready to do anything about them?
Well, I think, you know, I've been mostly focusing on Somalia this year, and I think if you look at that as an example and, you know, contrast it with what happened in 2010-11, you know, in 2010-11, 285,000 people ended up dying. Whereas this year, you know, we have, it's certainly a very concerning situation, and especially if we have a third drought this spring, which looks likely. But nonetheless, you know, there's a lot of food aid that's arriving there, and the response is, you know, much earlier and better than it was the last time this happened.
So there is some reason for being hopeful, at least with regard to Somalia. What about the United States? What role is it playing? It's my understanding that the Trump administration has talked about making cutbacks. Is it going to make cutbacks in the U.S. Geological Survey or in the Family Early Warning Systems Network?
Well, I can't, you know, I would say that predicting rainfall is a lot easier than making a forecast like that. You know, I can say that the Famine Early Warning Systems Network and humanitarian assistance has, you know, had wide bipartisan support for years, and, you know, right now is really doing a lot of good work.
So at the moment, at least, it's getting the kind of support that it needs, and yet we're hearing from the United Nations that they're only getting 10% of what they had hoped to get, $4.4 billion, by tomorrow.
It you know, it certainly is true, you know, what Jeffrey and Anne and Elizabeth were saying about how, you know, the sort of perfect storm of food insecurity that's involving both, you know, civil crises and droughts has really stretched the system.
What about this? And is there a reason for this? Is it attributable to global warming or not?
Well, so I would say that my research has suggested that part of it is certainly related to global climate change, but not most of it. So, you know, if you think about the 70 million food insecure people that we're looking at right now, you know, there's been a number of them that are located in countries like Malawi and Zimbabwe that were hit by anthropogenically enhanced El Nino last year. And now we're looking at the drought in Somalia, which is probably related to exceptionally warm sea surface temperatures in the West Pacific. So part of that puzzle has probably been exacerbated by climate change.
So there's 70 million people that are food insecure worldwide. We've talked a lot about Africa and the Southern Arabian Peninsula. Where are the rest of them?
Well, so certainly Syria is a major player in that, and we can also look at places like Yemen and South Africa and Tanzania. I mean, there's a lot of places where we have, you know, food crises and millions of people who are food insecure, but they're not quite at that pre-famine, you know, kind of conditions like we're looking at in Nigeria, South Sudan, Somalia, and Yemen.
Are most of them as a result of the climate change that you've talked about?
I couldn't generalize. You know, I think that in almost all these, a lot of these cases, you find an interplay of, you know, climate stress, which is going to be related to, you know, a poor rainy season and warming temperatures, usually interacting with issues of governance and poverty, low resilience. And so it's certainly true that climate change is exacerbating the problem, but it's really difficult to, you know, say out of that 70 million, you know, what the exact number would be.
Sure. Well, obviously, different things in different places. I want to go back to Elizabeth Bryant again with the World Food Program in Senegal. Mr. Funk just mentioned governance. To what extent is governance part of the problem here in various countries?
Well, I think at the moment, I mean, when you're looking, for example, at Northeast Nigeria, what we were just talking about, and the real problem is the conflict, and I think everybody was talking about this sort of perfect storm of different things. But you know, if you don't have a situation, regardless of who's involved with the in the conflict, if you don't have a situation where humanitarian groups can access people in need, that's the problem. Regardless of, you know, obviously governance plays a huge factor in terms of how the money is spent. But, in, you know, in terms of aid access, of getting food, and having the resources to reach people, having the funding to reach people, having a peaceful condition so that, you know, people can get back to their farms, et cetera, that's really critical, regardless of which system of governance and which country you're talking about.
Jeffrey Gettleman, back to you, our first guest, East Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times. What about the United Nations and the international effort to do something about all of this? Obviously, it is a worldwide a crisis. Is there a systematic approach to it, or is it somewhat haphazard?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, a lot of these problems are created by local dynamics. So in the area I was in Somalia a couple weeks ago, the town itself was controlled by the government, and just a few miles outside, it was controlled by the Shabab Islamic militant group. And those guys are not letting in any Western aid groups. So people are dying of cholera and of malnutrition just a few miles from where I was standing, and there was no way to bring them any help. And this goes back to state failure and the lack of institutions in Somalia and these bigger global dynamics driving the conflict there. But so I say that's like very local. But there are some bigger picture things that are happening. For instance, the World Food Program and some other UN agencies are starting with this cash transfers to send people money so they can buy food on local markets. And it seems really obvious, but it actually helps a lot because it helps the local economy. It puts money in people's hands. And it's a very fast way to get food, because instead of importing it from halfway across the world, you give merchants money and they'll find a way to get the food there. So that is a more global approach that I think shows a lot of promise and could be applied to a number of these situations in different places.
So Elizabeth Bryant with the World Food Program, it's not necessarily then that the food isn't there, it's that people can't afford to buy it?
I think it depends. It depends on the situation. I think what Jeffrey was saying was absolutely right. I mean, these cash transfers can be an amazing way to reach people. And as he said, I mean, in the places where markets are functioning, and that's a key issue, it's really fantastic because, as he said, you know, it's good for merchants. It also, you know, in a place where people are farming, it supports, you know, local production instead of importing food from, you know, halfway across the world. Plus, it's a lot cheaper to do so, not in all cases. However, that's not always the case. Markets aren't always functioning. In parts, like going back to northeastern Nigeria, you know, some of the markets are functioning, and others, you know, they can't get access because of insecurity. Trucks can't come in with the food, for example. But yes, I mean, it is a really good, it is one of many tools or a number of tools, depending on the situation, that can be used, and it is being expanded.
And Thomas, back to you, water sanitation hygiene chief at UNICEF. You're in Somalia. But what about education? You indicated that a lot of people, and we heard earlier, that people think that it's just the hot season and that's why they're getting cholera. They don't understand how simple it is to prevent that or what they can do. How much of an education effort is being made to try to acquaint them with how they can protect themselves?
Right. No, it's a good point. We're working very very hard actually on hygiene promotion, where we try and convey these messages. And one of the strategies we have for combating the sort of the awareness gap is basically been looking at mass media channels like radio and television. But another channel has been working with some of the local religious leaders and using that channel to see if we can influence people in a more meaningful way. So, you know, I think also relating to the issue of access, this has also been one of the challenges in a country where 70% of people have not gone to school. And we have a similar ratio of people who actually believe that the prayer is the best way to avoid disease. You know, it's a steep learning curve. And so we're really trying to bring on side every potential channel that we can to help influence people and really change behaviors in this crisis.
Something obviously that takes time as well. Do you have the resources or do you anticipate the resources you're going to need in order to maintain this effort?
Well, at the moment, our donors have been quite generous, and we're really happy. I think, as others have said, you know, the warnings have come earlier, the relief community has responded earlier, and the donors have been quite generous in putting money forward. However, I think, as Jeffrey said, we're still quite short in terms of where we want to be. And the first lines of intervention have been around water, basic water supply, clean drinking water, water treatment, provision of latrines in displaced persons camps. But this issue of mass media and really reaching people with messaging is something now that we're looking at more carefully. And we do have resources, but not quite where we want to be at the moment.
Chris Funk, back to you with the Famine Early Warnings Systems Network. You said you had focused principally on Somalia, but do you know of other areas of the world where this kind of problem is going to occur that we haven't yet talked about?
Well, sure. We're certainly seeing, you know, similar issues just across the border into, you know, eastern Kenya and northern Tanzania and southeastern Ethiopia. You know, we've done research showing that the warming in Yemen and South Sudan is making things, you know, drier, even if we may not be seeing rainfall reductions. So, and also, again, this idea that stronger El Niños may be producing droughts across, you know, many of the teleconnected regions of the world. You know, all kind of point towards increase in climate variability. And what we're seeing is that increased climate variability can disrupt advances in resilience. You know, so you have a poor household that's been saving up money or making their herd bigger, and then a bad drought comes and they're back to square one again. So I think, you know, these issues, for example, in Eastern Africa of water scarcity, you know, we need to find ways to empower people to manage both their finances and also perhaps store water and have access to that in a dry year.
Jeffrey Gettleman, back to you with the New York Times. You're in Nairobi, a big city in Kenya. You talked earlier about a sense of hopelessness in a lot of places, particularly rural places. But what about that metropolis? Is there a sense of hopelessness there, too? Are people worried about what's going on elsewhere in the country?
To some degree. And this is a regional drought. So even in Nairobi, the water in my house, I live in a nice neighborhood, we're running out of water. Many days the city turns off water and there's little water to shower with. The taps run dry. You can't do your laundry. I mean, I'm complaining about kind of mundane things compared to the other issues we've been talking about. But the point is, it affects everybody. Many Kenyans are connected to people up country, you know, friends and relatives that live in rural areas. And these areas have been pretty hard hit. Kenya will not have a famine, most likely, because there are decent roads and decent infrastructure to bring food from wherever and get it to people. There's nothing blocking the distribution of food like there is in Somalia or South Sudan. But it is a big concern. The economy of Kenya, and Kenya is one of the biggest economies in sub-Saharan Africa, is dependent on tea and other forms of agriculture, and all that's been hit really hard by this drought. And it looks like it's just started to rain, but it looks like it's going to be a pretty light rainy season, and then the drought and the heat and the dust and the dryness will be back on, you know, starting in June or July this year.
So very quickly, is there a relief in sight?
I don't think there's going to be a little bit of relief in sight for the next month. I think a place like Kenya is going to get a little rain. I think some of these areas in Somalia are going to get a little rain, but I don't think it's going to be the answer. And a lot of people have already lost so much that it's not going to mean anything. They don't have any farms anymore.
All right. So 70 million people with are food insecure worldwide, 20 million of them in Africa and the Arabian Peninsula alone. Thank you all very much for helping us better understand the situation. We'll see if, in fact, the Trump administration is going to be willing to spend the kind of money that the United States has spent in the past, never considered sufficient, but at the moment, perhaps subject to cutbacks. We'll find out as time goes on. Jeffrey Gettleman with The New York Times in Nairobi. Thank you so much for being with us. Ann Thomas with UNICEF in Somalia. Elizabeth Bryant with the World Food Program in Dakar, Senegal. And Chris Funk at UC Santa Barbara. He's with the U.S. Geological Survey and the Famine Early Warning Systems Network. Great to have you all, and many thanks. When it comes to Russian meddling, can the Senate succeed where the House has failed? Back in a moment with To the Point from Public Radio International. We're only with today's talking point. Republican Chairman Devin Nunes, with apparent help from the White House, has scuttled the House Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian meddling with last year's election. But the Senate Intelligence Committee, chaired by North Carolina's Richard Burr, is vowing to be nonpartisan. Here he is, Senator Burr, along with Virginia's Mark Warner, who is the leading Democrat on the committee.
This investigation scope will go wherever the intelligence leads it.
The chairman and I both have serious concern about what the Russians have done and continue to do around the world.
That was from the news conference yesterday. The committee started hearings today. Ollie Watkins is national security reporter for BuzzFeed in Washington. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What's come out of the hearing so far?
This one's been a bit of a snoozer, and we all kind of expected that. This hearing was not conducted or put on the schedule to really break news. This is a hearing. It's got two panels. It goes pretty much the whole day, and it's made up of mostly experts and scholars to kind of provide historical context. So I think it's supposed to be more of a symbolic step of, like, we are starting public hearings, not really looking at this for news value.
So we're not getting the head of the FBI, the head of the National Security Agency, not to mention some of the people who work for the Trump White House.
Yeah, no, alas, this is going to be a relative snoozer by the news standards of the last week, for sure.
Well, is that going to be the way, then, that this committee moves? Are they trying to avoid being sensationalistic and trying to move sort of quietly and to the extent that it's possible? I can't say behind the scenes, but are they hoping not to raise such a high profile?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, this hearing was scheduled long before the House Intelligence Committee implosion, if you will, of the last 2 weeks. But we did see the Burr and Warner press conference that was played at the top of the spot that was scheduled for Wednesday, and that was scheduled very last minute. This week is basically a very clear way for the Senate to say, we are not the House. And this hearing is kind of was smartly timed in that regard, because I think they are trying to take a very pragmatic, not necessarily slow, but more strategic path on this investigation. So I think that's kind of the point, to lay the groundwork here, and that's why they went for this hearing as their first public option.
In contrast to Devin Nunes, who was on the Trump transition team, Richard Burr, the Republican chairman from the Carolinas, has not been that big a supporter of the president, and he's not up for re-election. Does that have something to do, do you think, with the fact that he's willing to talk bipartisanship?
Absolutely. I mean, there is the differences between Burr and Nunes are very stark when you really go down to it, although it is worth noting that there was a moment in the Senate Intelligence Committee where it almost looked like they were going to go the way of the House. Burr has a really interesting relationship historically with the Trump team. He was advising the campaign briefly, and Trump did him no favors, really, in North Carolina. That was a battleground state. And Burr did not appear at many campaign events with Trump, was never angling for an administration job, and is also now not running for re-election. So he's in a really interesting place with this. A month and a half ago, we had the near implosion of the Senate Intelligence Committee when Burr received a call from the White House, and the White House asked Burr to talk to reporters and kind of tamp down some of these Russia-Trump stories, which Burr did. And that kind of erupted into this semi-public spat. But I think Burr is really trying to learn the lessons of that incident, which happened, I think, late January or early February. And the press conference Wednesday, I think, was his real moment to show that he is not Devin Nunes, he is not a Trump surrogate, and he did that pretty well.
We heard this kumbaya moment with Burr and Mark Warner, his Democratic counterpart, a moment ago. Has Warner now been mollified? Was he one who was sort of upset with Burr initially?
Yeah, absolutely. The real he was upset with Burr over that incident that I mentioned, which was kind of the real crux of that relationship, when Burr, at the behest of the White House, called these reporters without speaking to Mark Warner about it. And when that originally happened, Warner went out publicly and criticized Burr, which some Republicans saw as a very clear shot across the bow from Warner. But rather than playing out their spat in public, which Nunes and Schiff did, they kind of retreated into their private corners, worked things out behind the scenes. And then on Wednesday, we not only saw Mark Warner say that he has confidence in the investigation, he very explicitly said, "I have confidence in Senator Burr," which was a big moment because it's kind of been the running question as to whether people could trust the chairman, you know, whether you trust the process but don't trust the chairman. But I think Warner was trying to send a very clear signal, like, no, I not only trust this, I trust Richard Burr.
Hard for the House committee not to avoid publicity when Nunes himself went public saying that he got information somewhere on the White House grounds that he then revealed to the press and then to the White House before he told the Democrats on the committee. He was so public about it, I don't know how Adam Schiff could have been quiet or taken him behind closed doors and tried to work something out.
That was a very unilateral self-made destruction on the part of Nunes.
And now it appears that some of the people associated with him in the past, I believe Michael Ellis, who's now a White House counsel, didn't he work for Nunes at one point?
Yeah, he was on the HPSI staff fairly recently, if I'm recalling correctly. And those names, Michael Ellis and Ezra Cohen, had been floating around as the rumored sources, quote unquote, of Nunes. Since the day that he said he got the information, everybody kind of thought that it probably came from those corners.
HITSI, of course, short for House Intelligence Committee. What are the chances that there will now be big pressure put on Senators Burr and Warner and other members of that Senate committee? Is it going to be as easy as one might hope for them to continue this bipartisan investigation without getting into trouble, particularly with the White House?
You know, I think that for the moment, the trouble is kind of quelled. The next real roadblock I think you're going to possibly see is when they get to the point of interviewing Trump surrogates publicly, when they have to talk about what they're going to release publicly as a committee. And the way the Senate is conducting their investigation, it's worth noting, is that they're following a very strategic path that I don't know that they were following in the House. Their intention is to review intelligence community documents, then interview intelligence community personnel, and then interview Trump administration personnel, Trump associates, et cetera. So they are not even close to interviewing the Trump personnel yet. They're just starting to schedule interviews with intelligence community people.
One would assume that one, at least, of the former Trump associates would be General Flynn. There was some intention of interviewing him, apparently, by the House committee. That got squelched. Who else from the Trump White House or its association associates might be called to account?
They're trying to be kind of tight-lipped about it, but I've been told you can probably figure out who's going to be on that list. We're talking Paul Manafort, we're talking Carter Page, Roger Stone, Mike Flynn, et cetera. Kind of the main players that have been revolving around this Trump-Russia story since the beginning.
And they all have contacts with Russia of one kind or another, and they've all, or many of them, have Manafort indicated that he was willing to testify, but he wanted to do it in behind closed doors. Will the Senate try to get him to be public?
Absolutely. It's my understanding on a bipartisan basis from both sides of the aisle that they have every intention of bringing witnesses to public hearings.
Are they going to ask for Trump's tax returns?
Yeah, I mean, that's an area that they're just kind of starting to pursue. We've seen Ron Wyden really press on the financial side of things recently, which has not been talked about as much. And obviously, Senator Feinstein had talked about getting a hold of the tax returns for the investigation. So I think that's still a hurdle they haven't figured out yet either.
But again, the head of the FBI, the head of the NSA, those people would come after these lower-level folks and before, I take it, the people associated with the president.
Yeah, there's certainly an interest in talking with principals and former principals like, you know, a John Brennan, a Jim Clapper. But it's my understanding that there's also a real hope that they can interview actual workforce intelligence community people who helped put together this Russia assessment.
All right. Brennan, of course, former head of the CIA, Clapper, the director of intelligence. So we're going to see something interesting, but it's going to take a while. We're not going to be able to write a story about it this weekend.
No, I doubt it. This is not going to happen as fast as everyone wants it to.
Okay. Allie Watkins, an impatient national security reporter for BuzzFeed in Washington, as we all are. Thanks a lot for being on our show.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Marvin Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.